Thank you, Aaron. Again, fantastic. Thank you for leading us. If we can, let's just continue in what Aaron has led us in and just take a moment here to be silent, to let the Spirit of God move. So often in our gatherings, it's on to the next thing, on to the next thing, on to the next thing, on to the next thing. And sometimes I don't think we take a chance just to be still. So again, thank you, Aaron, in leading us. And if you guys will, just take a moment to be still and to pray and reflect on the songs we have sung, perhaps the scripture that's been shared and the words and the conversations we've had throughout the day, and just give a moment for the Lord to speak to us before we move on to that next thing. So if you don't mind, let's just take a minute and pray and be still. God, you are Lord. And forgive us when we forget that and don't act like that. Forgive us for when we do things for you without considering what you would have us do. And God, we thank you that you are so merciful and kind and forgiving and gracious to us. You are our God. We are your people. And we love you, and we praise you, and we honor you for who you are and what you have done for us. It is in your name that we pray. Amen. Well, in two sessions, I think we've covered a ton of ground, and a lot of this content is it can be a little difficult to grasp and put into practical use sometimes. I think the simple idea, remembering that you were made in God's image, is a very simple idea to grasp. It's hard to live out, and it's one that we'll fight the rest of our life. Point of why I'm bringing this up is I'm going to cut this content down for this lecture or this session short so that we can have a good bit of time together to talk and discuss and share and ask questions. I think part of the value of when youth leaders and pastors get together is the times of collaboration that we can have. And I know many of you have partaken of this throughout the day. I've been grateful to be allowed to join you for breakfast or rocking chairs on the porch where some of this collaboration is taking place. But it's also really good for us to do this in a group setting. I don't come here this weekend with the assumption that I'm teaching you things you've never heard before in your life and that you're not already working these things out in your local setting. So I'd like for us to have a good bit of time here at the end to talk about these ideas together, ask some questions, share some insight and some general good practices so that we have just a moment here together to really get into maybe the nitty-gritty in terms of practicality related to this content. Before that, I do want to talk about one of the biggest things we have to pass on to the next generation, but before we pass it on, we have to practice it ourselves. And it's about love. It's regarding love. This world is consumed with hatred right now. We already, prior to the shutdown, because of things like social media, we had begun to live in our own echo chambers. An echo chamber, if you get the idea, is we're surrounding ourselves with people who think just like us. And on social media, that's largely what our feed becomes, is an echo chamber, which, by the way, Facebook designs their algorithms for that very reason. It keeps you locked in the kind of content you already like, and then they market things to sell you based upon that. It's one of the major ways Facebook makes all of its money. So we live in these echo chambers where we're surrounded by people that think just like us, and they firm us, and then we've got that one person, you know, in our social media feed that's the protagonist, and he's always against, or the antagonist, and he's always against us, and or she's always against us, and we get into these fights sometime. But we've been living in these echo chambers, and when we live in these echo chambers, it's really easy to grow in hatred for those that are not like us. Good grief. And then the pandemic comes and the shutdown takes place and we are further isolated from people. And in isolation, it's really easy to grow in hatred, true hatred. Like, I wish this person was not alive. Or I wish these groups of people would just vanish off the face of the earth. To grow in just genuine hatred. But that's not the way of the follower of Jesus Christ, is it? In Matthew 5, verses 43 through 46, Matthew records the words of Jesus, and Jesus said this: "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy.' But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have?" What a stupid idea, right? Love your enemies? This is a ridiculous idea. Why should I love my enemies? Why should I pray for those who persecute me unless my prayer is, "Lord, wipe them off the face of the earth"? Why should we do this? The answer is actually quite simple, isn't it? There is none righteous, there is none good. And if God did not send the rain on the unjust, it would never rain anywhere. And none of us would be able to find the forgiveness and the mercy of our God. So praise be to a God who is slow to anger and abounds in mercy and sends the rain on the unjust, as we all were at one time. And if the God who is so loving towards us, who we were once his enemies, so are we as his children to love those who are our enemies. This idea, this ethic that flows from the cross, the love for your enemies, it changed the world once. And I think it will change the world again. But it must start with us. And we must model this before we teach it to the next generation. Tom Holland, not Spider-Man. I've made that mistake before in front of youth where I talk about Tom Holland, and as I'll get into this, he's a brilliant historian. And I've had students come up to me afterwards and go, "I had no idea that Spider-Man was a historian." I was like, all right, here we go. So Tom Holland is he's a writer, very good writer. He recently wrote a book called Dominion. And this Tom Holland is a historian, and of relevance, Tom Holland is an atheist. But as a historian, one of the things that really started to bug Tom was that when he would be studying ancient Rome, for example, he would begin to realize how foreign, how alien was the word he uses often, how alien his modern sensibilities, his modern morality, how foreign it was in the ancient world. The ancient world was a cruel, cruel place. Take Rome, for example. Enemies were hung on crosses as spectacles for all to see. That was the point of crucifixion, by the way. It wasn't just punishment, it was a warning to all that would come against Rome. You cross us, you go to the cross. And it was spectacle. People would die. Typically, it would take days to die upon the cross. And it was this big warning to the rest of the world: get on board or get out of our way. We do not cross us. This is what we do with our enemies. Slaves in the Roman Empire were used to build empires and provide sex on demand. Women were considered inferior to men and treated as tools that took care of the household and, like slaves, the lust of men. Babies, especially girls, were regularly left outside or thrown down drains to die. It was a world where, as Tom Holland writes, the marble fittings, the tinkling fountains, the perfumed flower beds, all were raised on the backs of the dead. And so as Tom Holland, an atheist who's also a historian, as he's, again, in the Roman world in his studies, he's realizing how his morality is foreign in this world. So he started to ask the question, my morals obviously didn't come from Rome. Where did my morals come from? And you know what his answer was? Christianity. It's very interesting. You should watch some of these discussions with Tom Holland. And just Google it, Tom Holland, not Spider-Man. Google that and you'll probably find who I'm talking about. And he talks about, as he's still, as best I can tell, still an atheist, but he said, in every meaningful way, I am truly Christian. And my ethics, the ethics that I have, it started with this man, Jesus Christ, and the writings of his followers, most notably Paul. The ethical implications that flowed from the cross changed Western civilization. And this is an atheist's conclusion. Tom Holland says it was like a depth charge. The teachings of Jesus and the writings of Paul, those are the two people he specifically mentions. These teachings were like a depth charge, an explosion beneath the foundation of the world that shook everything up. I mean, consider the great contrast. Rome took their enemies and put them on a cross to display their might and their power. Jesus, with unlimited power, chose to humble himself and go to the cross to die for his enemies. Jesus turned the world upside down. His followers carried that teaching and followed Jesus' example. And the world we live in today is a product of that. We're still feeling the ripple effects of it, though I think it's like, you know, this depth charge or this giant rock that was thrown into a lake and caused these ripple effects. Well, those ripples are slowly going away from our society, I think. They have hit the shore of secularism, if I can use that analogy. And it's time for the followers of Jesus Christ to lead by example and reclaim this. You see, we're living in a time where ethics is really starting to try to be, it's unplugging itself from God and from the Judeo-Christian heritage that we have. And this has been a work in the making. Going back many years, I'm sure many of you are familiar with Friedrich Nietzsche. And Nietzsche's most famous for his declaration that what? God is dead. Now, Nietzsche wrote a parable called The Parable of the Madman. It's a very interesting parable. You ought to go read it. It's very short. And in The Parable of the Madman, that's where Nietzsche famously declared that God is dead and we are all his murderers. The parable, though, is not a celebration of the success of modern, you know, civilizations destroying belief in God. It is mockery of the atheist hubris and the recognition of the struggle of replacing a worldview with something else. Because Nietzsche rightfully understood how much Western civilization was built on Judeo-Christian ethics, namely the ethic of sacrificial love for your neighbor and for your enemy. Now, Nietzsche was an atheist, and he said, we've got to get rid of belief in God, but he recognized the problem. If we get rid of belief in God, we get rid of everything else that comes along with that. Nietzsche was a very intellectually honest atheist. So in another one of his works, he wrote about this. In Twilight of the Idols, he wrote this. He said, if you abandon the Christian faith, at the same time you are pulling the right to Christian morality out from under your feet. This morality is very far from self-evident. This point needs highlighting time and time again, English fatheads notwithstanding. Christianity is a system, a synoptic, and a complete view of things. If you break one of its principal concepts, the belief in God, you shatter the whole thing. You have nothing necessary left between your fingers. So Nietzsche, an atheist, was a prophet in a sense that said, we have to abandon belief in God. And when we do so, we're going to break Western civilization. We're going to destroy the ethic that has produced the world we live in. But we need to do it. And Nietzsche, in his other writings, says, this is going to be okay. We'll recover from this. He alone is not one of these atheistic prophets. George Orwell, the famous author of 1984 and Animal Farm, he was another one of these atheistic prophets of sorts. He wrote a fantastic essay called Notes on the Way, in which he laments the success of removing belief in God from society. He wrote, for 200 years, we had sawed and sawed and sawed at the branch we were sitting on. And in the end, much more suddenly than anyone had foreseen, our efforts were rewarded and down we came. But unfortunately, there had been a little mistake. The thing at the bottom was not a bed of roses after all. It was a cesspool full of barbed wire. Gives me chills when I read that. Because here's an atheist recognizing they had been working so hard to kill off God, and it was like sawing off the branch they were sitting on. And they succeeded quicker than they thought they did, and down they came, and it wasn't a soft landing. They fell in a cesspool full of barbed wire. And of course, he's writing in the 20th century, the bloodiest century of them all. And today, clinical psychologist and best-selling author Jordan Peterson, who again is not, although he seems very close, he's not a Christian, I don't believe, yet. If you've not come across Jordan Peterson, you're in for a YouTube treat. He is brilliant, he is funny, he is witty. He's not a Christian, though it looks like you're watching like the public conversion of a really high-profile thinker, and it looks like he's pretty close to converting. But a year or so ago, he was on a really good debate show called Unbelievable. It's out of England. Justin Brierley is the host. And he was in, it was a conversation, not a true debate. But Susan Blackmore, who is an atheist, she was making the claim that, you know, look at the European societies. They're all atheist. And they're not, you know, going crazy and killing each other. They're not devolving into this chaotic, you know, everyone for themselves kind of civilization. They have gone godless and they are just fine. And Peterson was quick to point something out, though. He pointed out that though secularism is on the surface of these countries, their foundation was, and is to a degree still, a Christian one. He went on to warn, much like Nietzsche, that, and here's Peterson's quote, that we're living on the corpse of our ancestors. But that stops being nourishing and starts to become rotten unless you replenish it. And I don't think we are replenishing it, he said. We are living on borrowed time and are in danger of running out of it. And this is my concern for the church today. It seems that we have, to a large degree, abandoned much of our own heritage and the teachings of Jesus Christ. And rather than be committing to love our neighbor and most notably here our enemy as ourself, we are seeking to gain power to silence and control our enemies rather than love them. So more than ever, the followers of Jesus Christ alive today must not only preach but live out their ethics. And in very meaningful ways, love their enemy. What I want to give us briefly are just four principles and practices to help us grow in love for those we are inclined to hate. This isn't so much a do one, two, three, four kind of thing. It's really kind of four principles that will help our heart. Because I think our actions follow what's in our heart. Very often. So here are four principles and practices to help you. I think these principles and practices are also things you can pass on and teach to your youth. But here they are. Four principles and practices to help you grow in love for those you might be inclined to hate. First one, people are more than the sum total of their beliefs. And here's the significance of that statement. So those of you that are taking notes, by the way, some of you throughout this weekend, I should have mentioned this earlier, you're writing faster than a broke person at a Dave Ramsey conference. I'm happy to send you all of my notes. Feel free to reach out to me and I'll give that to you all. You like that joke? Yeah, all right, man, $5 for that joke and it's yours, you know. $5 too steep, how about $2.50?
I haven't been to the Dave Ramsey conference.
You haven't been to the Dave Ramsey? Okay, all right, fair enough. So that principle, again, people are more than the sum total of their beliefs. The significance to remind ourselves of that is that it's easy to hate an idea. And there are ideas and behaviors that should be hated. But it's not so easy to hate a person. When we reduce people, though, simply to their ideas and their behavior, we start to hate them. But are people the sum total of their thoughts and their actions? In a materialistic world, yes. In a Christian world where God exists, no. People in their essence, are image bearers of God, loved by Him. They are people whom Christ died for. He died for their bad ideas and their bad choices. He died to redeem them from their bad ideas and their choices, I should say. So people are more than their ideas and their beliefs. I have a funny story here. Really honest person. I love this man. And one day, just in conversation, he was just so frustrated with the state of political fighting, and he just blurts out something that many of you might amen. Don't do it in here. He said, "I hate Democrats." He goes, and he's being honest and really struggling with this because he's like, "No, I really am starting to hate Democrats." Like a true sincere, not funny, not glib, like a true sincere, "I hate Democrats." And I go, "Well, what about your friend Steve? He's a Democrat." And he goes, "Well, yeah, he's not one of those Democrats." I was like, "Wait, what do you mean one of those Democrats?" He's like, "Well, I know Steve." Aha, here it is, right? There was more to his friend Steve than simply his political beliefs. Steve, as far as I can tell, is exactly the kind of Democrat that my friend hates. But he doesn't hate Steve. Again, it's easy to hate ideas, and there are some ideas that should be hated because they rob, steal, and destroy. Now, be clear, I don't need to clarify anything there. Me clarifying there might have just made things more unclear. There are some ideas that are very bad and dangerous and harmful and should be hated. There are behaviors that are sinful, sinister, and destructive and should be hated. We have to be careful about reducing people to those things. It's very meaningfully a part of them in a sense. Yes, like we talked about yesterday in terms of identity, we're a combination of all of these things, and you are responsible for your thoughts. You are responsible for your actions. You don't just get to say, "Oh, I'm not what I do." I mean, yes, in terms of your essence, but you are responsible for what you do, so it's this kind of messy thing. But I think you understand my broader point, right? People are more. And when you get to know them, you see there's a person here, not just an ideology. And it's kind of hard to hate people. So principle number one, remember, people are more than the sum total of their beliefs. Principle number two, ideas must be understood. You're so polite, saying "bless you." It's kind of rude to me, though. You interrupted me. I'm joking. Ideas must be understood before they are challenged. Do you think a lot of that happens these days? No, we make snap judgments. We already have conclusions. And we don't seek understanding. We seek to destroy. Mortimer Adler wrote a great book called How to Read a Book. It's a book I wish I would have read much earlier in life. And one of his brilliant principles in that book is that you must be able to say, I understand, before you say, I disagree. And why this is a helpful principle in terms of loving your enemies. Now, I should have said this earlier. Most of us are enemies. They're not people that are out to take our heads and put us in prison. Now, I understand the political environment we're in and things like the Equality Act. Many Christians are rightfully concerned about, could prison be in our future for holding to orthodox, historic beliefs as it relates to Christian sexuality from a Christian standpoint? But as it is right now, when we talk about who are our enemies, we're not talking about it, and we just have to remember the context that we're in. So these principles here are very much catered towards an American context where the enemies that we have and the persecution we face is of a very light kind. Not to minimize the pain or the problems that it causes. But the reason this is an important point, you must be able to say, I understand before you say, I disagree. When you really understand why somebody has come to believe and think like they do, it creates compassion. It just does. You see, I see why you think like that. I still disagree, but now I understand why you believe this or believe that. But many of us don't seek that kind of understanding. We've already prejudged and think we already know it. It's funny how Christians on one hand will say, try to, you know, talk about humility and say, I don't know everything, but we sure act like we know everything. Social media feed looks like we know everything. So seek understanding before you seek to shut them up or refute them. And in the process, not only will you grow in knowledge and be better at confronting these ideas that you disagree with or these behaviors that you disagree with, but what I'm telling is going to develop in your heart is compassion for someone else. So a simple way to put this is listen before you lecture. Question before you critique. One of the skills that you really need to begin practicing and pass on to your students are the disciplines of listening and asking really good questions. I'll say that again for those of you that weren't listening. But nobody listens these days, do they? No, nobody listens anymore. I mean, think about the last kind of serious conversation you got in. And maybe it wasn't even serious. But let's put it in the, you're arguing about something important, whether it's politics, religion, or whatever, ethics. Someone's passionately making their case. And what are you doing while they're talking? You're thinking about what to say next, aren't you? And flip it around. You've been in that place where you're really laying out your case and they're not listening to you. They're thinking about what to say next. Is that a conversation? No, that's two people lecturing to an audience that isn't paying attention. It's a terrible way to go about convincing somebody of what you think is true. So nobody listens anymore. But listening is a very simple way to show somebody you love them. Listening is powerful. It conveys respect. So imagine you're in some situation where there's somebody that's becoming an enemy in your mind. Maybe you're pro-life and they're pro-choice. Maybe you're a Republican and they're a Democrat, or flip these two scenarios around. When you listen to somebody and truly listen, you want to hear past their arguments to the reason why they have these arguments. It conveys respect. And it is an act of love that relates to even the first point. It shows them you are interested in them as a person. You're not just concerned with arguing a belief that they hold. So listen. I know listening is very hard, and one of the simple ways that you can discipline yourself to listen and not worry about what to say next, and I do this all the time in pastoral ministry or whether I'm in some kind of apologetic conversation. You know, people, they talk, they say a lot of stuff in conversation, right? They'll go all over the place. It's never nice and neat. So I can really listen intently, not worrying about what to say to that or what to say to this, because I know at some point in the conversation I'm going to do this. I'm going to go something like, okay, so let me make sure I've heard you. You have said that your biggest problem with Christianity is, and then I'll repeat back to them what I think their main point is. This is powerful for, this is a simple thing, but it's very powerful for a number of reasons. One is it shows somebody I'm actually listening to you. I'm genuinely interested in you and understanding your point. I haven't pigeonholed you. I haven't stereotyped you. I want to know you and what you think. Second, it ensures that I really have heard them. Have you ever been in a conversation where you're talking back and forth and then the person says, you're not listening to me. You're responding to something I never even said. We all do that because we don't listen. So second, it ensures that I really know what they're saying. But third, and this is where it comes back to why this is so useful. When I say back to them, let me make sure I've understood you correctly. You think da-da-da-da-da-da-da. In that amount of time, you'd be surprised at how much you can think about what to say. That is the space to think about what to say next, not while somebody else is talking. Trust me on this. If you practice this, you're going to start to see immediate fruit. Not only are your conversations going to be more productive, anger is going to go down, and through the discipline of listening, your love for someone is going to increase. So coupled with the ability to listen well is the ability to ask a very good question. Some really good questions just for you to write down, by the way, are things like, how did you come to that conclusion? What do you mean by that? Don't assume you understand the way somebody is using a word. It's very likely you've been in conversations recently where you and somebody are using the same word, but you mean something totally different. So what do you mean by that? When you say Christians should just love people and not judge them, what do you mean by that? What does it mean to love somebody? What do you mean don't judge? So how did you come to that conclusion? What do you mean by that? Are two really good questions. I've got a lot of stories I would love to tell about the power of listening and asking questions, but in the sake of us wanting to get to where we can talk together, I'm going to skip them. Third thing. So people are more than the sum total of their beliefs. Ideas must be understood before they are challenged. Third, delayed judgments are better than wrong judgments. We're very quick to make judgments these days, and in one particular way that lends itself towards us hating somebody and viewing them as our enemy. We're really quick to judge someone's motive. We see an action, we read about it in the news, we get a headline or a tweet, and we go, they did this because they are a fill in the blank. Or they did this because, and we assign motive to their actions. It's really hard to judge motive, isn't it? Sometimes we don't even know why we do what we do. But again, when you judge someone's motive without really knowing what has happened or even knowing the person really, they become a villain in your mind. They are reduced to some caricature that becomes very easy to hate. You haven't been gracious. You haven't sought knowledge. You've just declared from your removed, you know, far removed perhaps from a situation and made a judgment about something there's no way you could ever know. Judging someone's motivation only to learn that you were wrong, or let me put it this way, judging someone's motivation, forming a firm conclusion, and treating them accordingly, later to find out you were wrong, That is injustice. To be wrong in judging someone's heart and then treating them accordingly, you have now just committed an injustice. Delaying judgment because you don't have enough information to reasonably conclude they did this because they hate you, because they're fearful, because they're jealous. Say, you know, maybe they are. I'm going to delay my judgment. And then maybe many years later, you come to find out your initial assumption was right, and then consequences follow that, is simply delayed judgment, delayed justice. Making a bad judgment quickly and then acting on that is an injustice. Holding back your judgment because you can't know, waiting for relevant information to come along, no matter how long it takes, is simply delayed justice. I want to parse out judgment in the way that I hope it's given to me. I want God to be gracious to me and judge rightly. And I want other people to do that as well. So may we, the followers of Jesus Christ, do that. Delay judgment and be careful about concluding on someone's motivation when you can't know. That's what mobs do. They light the torch, they grab the pitchforks, and they worry about details later. Disciples seek to be good judges who ultimately trust in the goodness and the justice of God. Vengeance is His. No evil deed escapes His eye, and before Him, every knee will bow and give account for all they have done. And may He be as gracious to our enemies as we hope He is with us. The Lord is the only perfect and true judge of one's heart. May we leave to God what is rightfully His, and let us continue to pray for our enemies. Which is the last point. It's hard to hate someone when you're praying for them. I'm sure you've heard that before. You may have a real, legit, true enemy. And maybe you've even done all of these things. Maybe you have recognized that they're not the sum total of their beliefs and you've sought to be gracious to them that way. Maybe you really understand why they think like they think and it's helped you a little bit. Maybe you've delayed a judgment again and been very gracious towards them. You have tried to humanize them. And maybe they're still after you and still trying to make your life hell. Still pray for them. Still pray for them. That the God of mercy would find them and forgive them and stop them. But pray for them rather than be consumed with hatred for them. Go to bed on your knees rather than getting into your covers and playing out your venge-filled fantasies. This kind of love, that there's many more ways for this love to come out in our actions and our behavior. These are just a simple starting point, I think, to help us condition our hearts to love those who disagree with us and maybe, in fact, are true enemies. But this kind of thinking and this kind of love changed the world once. Our country needs this kind of love again. May it start with us, may our youth see it, and may we pass it on to them also in the way that we teach. Amen. Thank you, guys.